I ended the last lecture with an ecstatic account of the marital happiness of Othello and Desdemona as they arrived on the island of Cyprus. There is one detail to be added to that account. During that full-throated epithalamion, Iago is standing always on the side of the stage. And at the end of it, he says quietly, "Oh, you are well tuned now. But I'll set down the pegs that tune that music." Iago proposes to destroy their happiness, to destroy the music, which is always a symbol of harmony in Shakespeare, to produce discords on the pegs. Why? Iago is one of the big problems in Shakespearean criticism. There has been much throwing about of brains as to why Iago chooses to destroy Othello, Desdemona, Cassio, Rodrigo, the rest of them. Why does he do the terrible things he does? He does acknowledge some motives. He soliloquizes to us frequently and mentions some 5 or 6 reasons why he should be doing this. First, that Othello has deprived him of a post that he felt he deserved. He should have promoted Iago to be his lieutenant. Instead, he passed Iago over and appointed Michael Cassio. That sounds quite legitimate when first we are introduced to the motive. The trouble is, he forgets that after a while, and we begin to get other motives. That, for example, Othello has cuckolded Iago, slept with his wife, Amelia. Then he mentions later on that he fears Cassio with his nightcap too, that Cassio may have cuckolded him with Emilia. There's one passage in which he seems to admit a desire for Desdemona himself. That's not quite clear. That's why I had to say 5 or 6 motives. It certainly is the motive for Iago in the source story, the Italian tale by Cinzio that Shakespeare was adapting. But it's not quite clear that it carries over. He does admit that there is a daily beauty in Cassio's life that makes him feel ugly. And finally, he says that he wants to plume up his will in double knavery. To plume up my will in double knavery, whatever that means. Just to enjoy being wicked. The difficulty with this is, of course, there are too many motives, and none of them are dwelt upon with the kind of insistence that would really make them convincing. When a man in Shakespeare is jealous of his wife, we hear about it at great length, not just a passing, "I fear Cassio with my nightcap." When a man is ambitious, when a man is disappointed, Shakespeare writes long speeches about these things. These motives are tossed off and left to dangle as they may. At the end of the play, Shakespeare apparently refuses to explain Iago altogether. All the characters on stage want to know why Iago has done what he's done, once it is revealed in the final scene what he has done. And in particular, Othello says, "Demand that demi-devil why he hath thus ensnared my soul and body." And Iago replies, "Demand me nothing. What you know, you know. From this time forth, I never will speak word." And indeed, he never does. He has no further lines in the play. Iago declines to explain himself to others. He declines to open his motives to them or to us. Well, perhaps there's a clue in one word that Othello just used. Demand that demi-devil. Why? Is Iago a demi-devil? It has been argued with some frequency that Iago embodies an abstract form of evil that is derived from the older allegorical drama of the Middle Ages. The primary statement of this lies in a book called Shakespeare and the Allegory of Evil, written by a distinguished scholar called Bernard Spivak. He argues that the figure of Iago is based on the medieval character of the vice. The medieval drama put in the center of the stage an everyman figure, a mankind figure, a representative of us all, and put on opposite sides of him virtues showing him the steep and thorny path to heaven and vices inviting him down the primrose path of dalliance to hell. And the vice figure was the most popular character in the English medieval drama, the one whom the audience most loved. The vice, with a capital V, posed as being a friend of his victim, devoted to the welfare of mankind. He also gloried in his deceit. He practiced seduction as a sport. He developed a special relationship with the audience because he did a lot of soliloquizing. Look how I'm going to seduce this foolish young man into sinfulness. He was, in fact, a stage manager of the action put on stage to control it. And in this medieval drama, vice seduces every man without any real personal motive for it, simply in fulfillment of his nature as a vice. The vice is a tempter, simply as it is the function of the Statue of Liberty to hold up the torch of freedom. An allegorical person. In this view, in Spivak's argument, the core of Iago is this old medieval tempter. And the few human motives that are mentioned by Iago in the course of Othello are just put on to put a few scraps of clothing onto the bare allegorical bones. Now, this is a good argument. There is much reason to associate Iago with such a figure. Iago frequently invokes hell during the course of Shakespeare's play. At the end of Act One, he begins to have an idea of what scheme he will practice on Othello, and he says in soliloquy, "I have it, 'tis engendered. Hell and night must bring this monstrous birth to the world's light." And at the end of Act Two, when he has developed the plan further, he has a soliloquy beginning, "Divinity of hell, theology of hell. I am working out the arguments of hell. When devils will the blackest sins put on, they do suggest at first with heavenly shows as I do now. I am behaving like a devil." The imagery of hells and devils frequently surround Iago. Long before Othello calls him a demi-devil at the end of the play. It climaxes at the end of the play with that demi-devil line and one other very revealing line of Othello's. "I look down at his feet, but that's a fable." He's looking down at Iago's feet expecting to see a cloven hoof, expecting to see the devil's foot. Now, there is a great deal to all this. The scholars who have explored the medieval background of Shakespearean drama have performed a valuable service in explaining the ancestry of Shakespeare's practices, explaining the concepts and patterns which the drama had been previously using and which were therefore readily available to Shakespeare and his fellow playwrights, readily comprehensible to his audience. Any playwright in any period needs such a collection of concepts or forms to dramatize his stories with. That doesn't mean he needs to stick to them. It doesn't mean he can only deploy the same old stereotypes. But to achieve communication, you need to have some common ground. A playwright needs both originality and old stuff. He needs stereotypes before he can start remolding them into something that's appropriate to his particular purpose at the moment that he's writing this play. So I think this is relevant. Let me pause here and go on to a different kind of explanation. On the other hand, we need not run full tilt into the medieval past to explain Iago and say Iago is only a relic of the Middle Ages. There are modern explanations, too. If the medievals had their concepts and schemes and allegories, so do we also in the 20th century. And the chief inventor of patterns and concepts that describe and explain human behavior in the 20th century are the psychologists. Modern specialists see men in a psychic pattern, caught in the toils of the unconscious. In particular, several psychoanalysts have produced brilliant readings of Iago as motivated by unconscious, repressed homosexuality. This argument goes as follows. He is in love with Othello and in love with Cassio, or at least attracted to them both. They are both highly attractive men. But he cannot permit himself to recognize this fact. So he proceeds to cope with it by a variety of unconscious strategies. Now, so far, there certainly seems to be something to this. He's fascinated with both Cassio and Othello. He pays them much more attention than he pays his own wife. The strategy is to destroy the objects of his love. They pose a threat to him. If he ever has to face what he really feels about them, that will be that will ruin him. He's terribly resentful of them, so he wants to ruin them first. That is, he's going to displace or reject his love for them by foisting it on Desdemona, saying, "I don't desire Cassio, I don't desire Othello, she does. Therefore, let us punish them all for being involved in these wicked desires." There is much to this. You can find support in the lines of the play. I quoted a moment ago the line saying, "There is a daily beauty in Cassio's life that makes me ugly." That's a point where his admiration of Cassio seems to surface in the spoken script and not just be subtext. There's something even more revealing when he's tempting Othello into believing that Cassio has slept with Desdemona. He invents a dream that he reports Cassio as having had. He and Cassio spent the night together, shared quarters one night. And he, Iago, being troubled with a raging tooth, could not sleep. There are a kind of men so loose of soul that in their sleeps will mutter their affairs. One of this kind is Cassio. In sleep I heard him say, "Sweet Desdemona, let us be wary, let us hide our loves." Okay, Cassio babbled in his sleep about being in love with Desdemona. That's okay, but look where it goes from there. "And then, sir, he would grip and wring my hand and cry, 'Sweet creature,' and then kiss me hard, as if he plucked up kisses by the roots that grew upon my lips, then laid his leg over my thigh and sighed and kissed again and cried, 'Cursed fate that gave thee to the Moor.'" Iago is playing out a fantasy of Cassio making love to him. Now, the whole point, and it's pretty hot fantasy, too. The whole point is to inflame Othello, but it may tell us more about what's really going on in Iago's mind in the lower reaches. That would suggest the relation with Cassio, the desire for Cassio. The desire for Othello is there in the whole temptation of Othello into jealousy of Desdemona. The deception of Othello is played as a very long step-by-step scene in the middle of the play. It is, in fact, a seduction scene as Iago gets closer and closer to the personal affairs of Othello. And it ends with their swearing a vow to each other. Iago kneels on stage and says, "Witness, you ever-burning lights above, you elements that clip us round about, witness that here Iago doth give up the execution of his wit, hands, heart, to wronged Othello's service." And Othello replies, I greet thy love, not with vain thanks, but with acceptance bounteous. Now art thou my lieutenant. And Iago replies, I am your own forever. The two of them are kneeling on stage, swearing this vow of eternal loyalty. It is almost a marriage scene, a wedding scene. It carries that impact. Well, this is a possible modern interpretation of Iago's motivations, and it has been used in modern productions by no less a person than Laurence Olivier. Laurence Olivier had already played a Freudian Hamlet. Then when he went on to play Iago opposite the fellow of Ralph Richardson, he called up Ernest Jones, the disciple of Freud, from whom he got the Freudian ideas about Hamlet, and said, can you give me some Freudian ideas about Iago, too? And what I have just explained is what he got, and Olivier worked that out into the staging. Richardson, playing Othello, didn't really understand what he was doing. Richardson didn't go in for this kind of thing at all. And there is a famous moment where, in rehearsal, Olivier kissed Richardson on the mouth, and Richardson said, dear boy, this will never do. And as a matter of fact, the idea did not, in fact, do. This took place in 1937. Freudian ideas were not very widespread in England at that time. The audience didn't understand what was going on. If you read the critics reviewing that production, you will see that they don't understand. They didn't understand. Nonetheless, it's a possible idea, and I have no objection to an actor's preparing a role in this kind of depth psychological way. And I've no real objection to Freudian analysis as a sort of intellectual exercise. There is a problem here that you are working on the play as if it were a case history. You can't actually put Iago on the couch and ask him to free associate and do the sort of Freudian analysis that you would with a live patient. Both the medieval vice theory and the psychoanalytic repressed homosexual theory resort to abstract patterns to find a context for some rather mysterious behavior. I want to put these two ideas together, the medieval idea and the 20th century idea. They really are both abstractions for behavior that we find painful to acknowledge. It is really we who need an explanation for hatred, for Iago's lust to destroy others. I think the Freudian idea is as much an allegory as the medieval idea. Both of them tend to flatten out the tortured humanity of Iago. Promiscuous hatred of the kind exemplified in Iago does exist in human life. It disturbs us deeply. We ache to know why it should exist. To know why might help us deal with the pain. It might perhaps help us know what to do if we encountered a person as consumed with hatred as Iago is. You notice we do this with unpleasant feelings. If there is someone who is bountiful, loving, generous to all mankind, we don't ask what peculiar complex in that person makes him so forthcoming. We do it with evil and disturbing things. Actually, I don't think Shakespeare has to supply us with an explanation. He supplies us with the experience. That's his business as a playwright, to show us what hatred and envy are like. Hatred and envy and destructiveness. He recognizes that we want explanations. He has Othello ask at the end of the play, why has he ensnared my soul and body? Even more, he has Iago ask. He has Iago offer up those six motives that I listed at the beginning, as if he himself were trying to figure out why he is so hateful. I've been saying throughout these lectures on tragedy that Shakespeare does not have an all-encompassing explanation of the meaning of tragedy. Rather, that he allows the characters to probe the meaning of their suffering. It is part of the tragic experience that he writes that the characters themselves are perplexed by it. It is part of the suffering that they go through an effort to find explanations, that they try to account for it to themselves. In this particular case, in the case of Iago, we find a man asking not why he's suffering, but why is he inflicting suffering on other people? I think the hatred is greater than any explanation we can offer for it, any explanation than Iago can offer for it. A very famous phrase has been applied to it by the early 19th century poet and critic Samuel Taylor Coleridge. Coleridge described Iago's favorite activity as the motive hunting of motiveless malignity. The motive hunting of motiveless malignity. He is malign, it is without a motive, and he himself hunts for the motive. I think that phrase captures something essentially accurate about Iago. The malignity does transcend the motive. Iago desires to do dirt on life. That, by the way, was D.H. Lawrence's phrase for it. To blacken what is true or good or beautiful. Or to use Iago's own phrase, to turn their virtue into pitch. That envy of the daily beauty in Cassio's life that makes him ugly. I think he also envies Othello and Desdemona's beauty. There's a bit in Iago of the homely, chubby, greasy-haired high school boy who isn't popular and who envies the in-crowd, the school leaders, the athletes and the cheerleaders, and who gets back at them by being cleverer than they are, by entrapping them with his wit. He certainly dislikes anything that they have that is beautiful. Therefore, when he describes the imagined sex between Desdemona and Othello, of course he hadn't seen them having sex, he describes it in that terrible way. They're making the beast with two backs. An old black ram is tupping your white ewe. He likes starting brawls. He likes starting fights. He starts a riot in the first scene of the play with Brabantio's servants. He gets Cassio drunk in the second act, and that turns into a sword fight. And there's a third brawl in the streets in the last act, which results in Rodrigo's death and the wounding of Cassio. The man is possessed by an irrational hatred. He desires, again in his phrase, to enmesh them all. What's really strongest in the writing of Iago is not the explanations offered, but the verbs describing the activity, to turn virtue into pitch, to enmesh them all. He despises most of the rest of mankind. He despises any man who does not keep his heart strictly attending on himself, any man who fails to be guided by self-interest. And yet it irritates him enormously that in this preposterous world, men and women who do have instincts of generosity and regard for honor and honesty, such as Desdemona, Othello, Cassio, somehow manage to be thought well of, even are successful. They are successful. In Othello's case, they are also powerful and noble and generous and true and imaginative. Iago just can't bear that. He's got his own doctrine of life, which is entirely self-centered. Shakespeare gives him a complete set of beliefs about how human beings should really behave. This comes at the end of the Senate scene. He's talking to Rodrigo alone after everyone else has left the stage, the end of Act 1, Scene 3. And Rodrigo mentions virtue. Iago responds, virtue? A fig. Tis in ourselves that we are thus. Our bodies are our gardens, to the which our wills are gardeners. So that if we will plant nettles, or sow lettuce, set hyssop and weed up thyme, why the power and corrigible authority lies in our wills. That is, we can do what we want with ourselves. Make ourselves full of nettles, or make ourselves full of lettuce. To go back to quoting him, if the balance of our lives had not one scale of reason to poise against another of sensuality, the blood and baseness of our natures would conduct to most preposterous conclusions. We have reason to cool our raging motions, our carnal stings, our unbitted lusts, whereof I take this that you call love to be a sect or scion. Love is merely a lust of the blood and a permission of the will. We are completely in control. We are gardeners to the gardens of our bodies. Our wills can do what we want. Our wills can control our passions. And love is just a passion, a lust of the blood, seconded by a permission of the will. Now, this is sound Elizabethan psychology. They did believe that the reason should control the passions, that we were given our wills to exert that control, that we were full of lusts left over from the fall of Adam, from our corrupted natural condition, but that the will and the reason should control our desires in this fashion. This doctrine, in other words, that Iago is preaching to Rodrigo, has enough truth in it to be plausible. In fact, a great deal of truth. What's wrong with it is simply what is left out. Iago supposes that the individual human will is all-powerful. He does not admit the existence of any other power, that there might be anything like grace in the world, God's power. God's gift to strengthen us in our overcoming our baser desires. God's mercy, God's forgiveness. He denies implicitly, in this description of our psychology, any spiritual operation. That love is anything more than a lust of the blood and a permission of the will. That love might be a genuine attraction toward another person. Finding in that other person something comparable to ourselves. Finding in that other person beauty. Finding in that other person an image of God. He denies implicitly any sort of imagination that sees beyond ourselves as fleshly creatures. He denies any heroism, any self-sacrifice. He denies all those things that make us more than calculating animals. Iago's viewpoint on human beings is really rather simple. It is also rather brutal, and I mean that literally, animalistic, of the brutes. And finally, rather dull, in the way he limits the possibilities of humankind. His effect on other people is malignant. His effect on the audience can be mesmerizing. For a while we follow this man as he exerts his great cleverness, his cynicism, his resourcefulness. We even may be amused by him as he plays tricks on other people, until we realize how empty, narrow, and destructive it is, how much it hurts other people whom we, in fact, like much more. Other people who have possibilities for heroism, love, and self-sacrifice. A quick way to place Othello in Shakespearean context is to say that he's the opposite of Hamlet. Hamlet is young. He's a university student. He's coming to grips with the world and its realities. Othello is middle-aged, late 30s, early 40s. He's seen the world, including exotic parts of it that most of us have never seen. And he's very familiar with the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. Hamlet is a student. Othello is a soldier. Hamlet is European. Othello is African. Both are princes. Othello mentions that he fetches his being from men of noble siege, of royal siege. But Othello's behavior is not dependent on that inherited rank in the way that Hamlet's is. He has left his original country, whatever that was, and lives among Europeans on the basis of what he has achieved, what he can do, what he has done. It is true, but not very important, that he was born great. It is both true and important that he has achieved greatness even before the play has started. Perhaps the most important contrast between Hamlet and Othello lies in the matter of their respective freedom. Hamlet is not free. In no respect did he create the situation in which he finds himself at the start of his play. He was born the prince of a certain country. His father was murdered. His mother married a man he detests. He is not permitted to return to Wittenberg to continue his university career as he would like. He has a duty imposed upon him by a ghost. He greatly resents the situation in which he is placed. The time is out of joint, O cursed spite, that I was ever born to set it right. But he cannot escape that situation. He cannot choose even to die. Suicide is forbidden by divine command. The relationship most dependent upon human choice, the relationship of love, is a failure for him. Forbidden by Polonius, Ophelia withdraws from Hamlet and returns the love tokens that he has given her, and thus excites his jealous suspicion. Othello, on the other hand, is very much a self-made man. He's not bound by his past, bound by his circumstances. His past is, in fact, a fascinating, exotic narrative which gives him a certain power over the present. The narrative of his history is what enables him to win the love of Desdemona. His mother has bequeathed him a handkerchief with magic in the web, but she presents no current claim upon him. His position in the Venetian state is contractual. He is a condottiere. He's a soldier of war of very great distinction who has been hired by the Senate of Venice to command the Venetian armies. This was a familiar position in Renaissance Italian city-states, the condottieri who runs the troops. These people were held in tremendous respect. In fact, there is a statue in Florence by Donatello of a condottiere called Gattamelata. There is another one in Venice of a condottiere called Caleone, sculpted by Verrocchio. Great heroic statues of generals on horseback. This is the kind of distinguished position that Othello holds. The Venetian Senate are what he calls my very noble and approved good masters, and to them he owes loyalty, but they are his masters because he and they have chosen that it should be so. And presumably that relationship could be ended at any time they decided. They need him, in fact, more than he needs them. They need him to protect him, Venice, against the Turks. That is, his loyalties are not the conflicting kind that one inherits, the sort of loyalties that Hamlet has. They are those few loyalties that he has chosen. And for him, the choice of love, above all, has been supremely free. The relation between Othello and Desdemona owes nothing to circumstance, nothing to inherited givens. it successfully defies the surrounding circumstances. Love flourishes between a middle-aged African wanderer and a young Venetian aristocrat because they have chosen that it should, despite their unlikeness and despite whatever anyone else may say about it. There is claustrophobia that occurs at the end, toward the end of this play. I mentioned that in an earlier lecture. But the claustrophobia is all the greater because the acts of freedom are so strong at the beginning. Othello's choice of Desdemona, Desdemona's defense of her choice of Othello in front of the whole Senate, even Iago's choices. Everybody in this play starts by triumphantly asserting their freedom. That's why the end can get so painful, where everybody is so trapped. Hamlet held a Renaissance ideal of man, that man was in form and moving, how express and admirable, in action, how like an angel. Well, Othello does not have the philosophical subtlety of Hamlet. He's not going to quote Pico della Mirandola on the freedom of man. He doesn't need to. He's achieved the Renaissance perfection of action that Hamlet can only dream of. He acts with unfailing resourcefulness in the opening scenes of the play. Until he is enmeshed in jealousy by Iago in the second half of the play, he is in control of whatever contingencies develop. He is courteous, exquisitely courteous to Brabantio when Brabantio is objecting to his marriage to Brabantio's daughter. Good senior, you shall command more with your years than with your weapons. Don't put up swords against me. I will respect you as my aged father-in-law. He is very respectful to the Senate, addressing them as most potent, grave, and reverend signors, my very noble and approved good masters. When he has to make a judgment of the drunken Cassio, he marvelously balances his personal affection with the necessary condemnation. Obviously, he has to fire Cassio. You can't have a drunk man in charge of the military garrison in an exposed imperial outpost. But at the same time, he doesn't want to repudiate the personal friendship with Cassio, especially since Cassio is now sobering up and obviously feeling just terrible about what he's done in the last hour. So Othello says to him, Cassio, I love thee, but nevermore be officer of mine. His knowledge, as well as his military skill, makes him valuable to the Senate, and they feel able to rely upon him absolutely. Everybody except Iago holds a very high opinion of Othello in this play, and consequently they find his alteration in the later scenes astonishing. Lodovico arrives from Venice when Othello is fallen into jealous rage and says, is this the noble Moor whom our full Senate call all in all sufficient? And when Othello has done one of the most painful things he does in public, he slaps his wife, Desdemona, in front of a crowd of people. Lodovico can only say, this would not be believed in Venice. I think we have to take that line as an accurate indication of how Othello normally behaves and what damage Iago has done to him. The imposing quality of Othello is partly created by verbal elements, by the imposing quality of his speech. Othello talks in a manner unique to himself. In what has been described in a famous essay by Wilson Knight as the Othello music. It is a matter of strong verbs, often imperatives, accompanied by brilliantly vivid imagery. That command when the riot breaks out in the first act of the play, one of the first things Othello says in the play, keep up your bright swords, for the dew will rust them. It's a matter of picturesque and exotic imagery. He calls the Turks Ottomites. He speaks of the anthropophagi whose heads do grow beneath their shoulders. He talks of the Arabian Sea. He idealizes Desdemona as being one pure chrysolite. Lovely word, chrysolite. And that all-important handkerchief, he describes it, its origin as a sibyl in her prophetic fury wove it. It's the sort of thing that might have been made on the Michelangelo ceiling, on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, one of those sibyls up there, full of prophetic fury, put it together. Perhaps the most famous speech is the speech when he vows revenge and compares the strength of his vow to the power of the sea rushing through the Hellespont. Like to the Pontic Sea, whose icy current and compulsive course ne'er feels retiring ebb, but keeps due on to the Propontic and the Hellespont, even so my bloody thoughts with violent pace shall ne'er look back, ne'er ebb to humble love, till that a capable and wide revenge swallow them up. Now by yon marble heaven, in the due reverence of a sacred vow, I here engage my words. I can't do it very well. What this needs, the most famous thing it has received in the 20th century, is the voice of Paul Robeson, who was also a great singer. If you have an opportunity to get a recording of that or to hear a recording of that, you will find that that great bass voice just rolls across the auditorium like a bass in a Bach oratorio. The language certainly makes it possible. That's a long, careful comparison, the strength of the vow to the power of the sea rushing through the straits. There are grand single words, Pontic, Hellespont, Propontic, sonorous, aural solids. And of course, the simile involves a physical movement of great majesty, which is reflected in the stateliness of the speech rhythms, in the conceptions, in the formality of the vow, in the utmost silhouetted clarity of what he is saying. That is how Othello speaks. And the command, the nobility, the heroic authority of this figure is tremendously reinforced by one more factor, his color. Now, the blackness of Othello is a very complex subject. I cannot handle it adequately in a short lecture, obviously not, because the racial issues are so complicated and so conflicting for us now at this time in our history. The issue of the racial difference arouses so many anxieties, distresses, and fears. I can say a few things that will stimulate your thought and leave you to work on with the matter. First, if we think that Othello is deceived by Iago simply because he's black, that is, that Shakespeare thought black people would be more easily tricked, more easily wrought into murderous passion by a bunch of lies than white people are, then the play is racist. There is a fundamental racist premise in the play, and I don't want to say anything more in defense of it. I don't think that's true, but there are one or two lines which good critics have used to suggest that that assumption sometimes is at work in the play. Second, if we think that Othello believes himself to be inferior to white Europeans, that is, if we think that he has internalized the prejudice of the dominant society amongst which he is now living, then I think we have missed the real self-confidence of the character. I think, in fact, what we've done is to load onto an early 17th century script the history of racism as it has developed in subsequent centuries. Othello is presented as being exotic. He is presented as being distinguished. He is also a welcome guest, frequently invited to Brabantio's household, and certainly welcomed in the Senate, who eventually applaud his marriage to Desdemona. The only people who express any objection to Othello being Desdemona's husband are Iago, who hates everybody, and Brabantio. My point is this. Othello has not shared the hideous history of centuries of slavery, of ghetto life, and of subtler forms of discrimination that we now are all too familiar with. He is an African prince at a time when such people were new in European experience. He is different, strikingly different. He is, as we now say, other. But that otherness is not regarded with disdain, except by Iago. The villain of this play is a white man, not a black man. I want to bring up his color in connection with his heroism, with his authority over others, because the blackness is so important on the stage, because the blackness makes him such a striking figure. Even when the issue of his race is not being spoken of, every time he's there on the stage, it is part of our apprehension of him. This magnificent figure, our eye goes to him every time he appears, in whatever stage grouping. Shakespeare uses the color in a great many different ways. The Elizabethans certainly did use black also as a term of moral condemnation. And when people are angry at Othello late in the play for mistreating Desdemona, then the blackness can be used as a term of moral condemnation. There's a moment when Emilia is very angry and she says Desdemona was too fond of her most filthy bargain. There she's using the color in a racially prejudiced way. But for most of the time, the color is important for its sheer visual impact. He looks as well as sounds, separate and free and commanding, utterly his own person. And that is why the issue of commitment is so important in this play. That Othello himself speaks of his unhoused free condition. He has lived a life of freedom, only of certain kinds of contractual arrangements, such as that with the Venetian Senate, which could be ended. The marriage to Desdemona is the one great commitment that changes him, that makes him different. One of his initial responses to the temptation by Iago is to say, "Why did I marry?" It's almost a comic moment. You can imagine anybody saying in a moment of irritation about the restraints of domestic life, why did I do this? I was happier when I was a bachelor or a spinster or whatever. But his capacity for commitment is all the greater because he starts from that free position. Now, I've spent all this time stressing the greatness, the heroism of Othello, deliberately. Because it seems to me that Shakespearean criticism, criticism of the play, often ignores or belittles the nobility of the Moor. It does so because late in the play he does have moments of extraordinary degradation. His jealousy drives him into what looks like an epileptic fit, in which he actually rolls and foams on the floor. And Iago sneers at him, standing over his helpless body. Emilia does have that line about her most filthy bargain. Othello does get subjected to the constant criticism of Iago. And he gets subjected to something else, the constant fault-finding of Shakespearean critics, who find this kind of noble, heroic character pompous or self-inflating or dramatizing. Many Shakespearean critics of the 20th century have not particularly cared to be taken in, as they consider it to be, taken in by a romantic figure. And I think Othello is a romantic figure. The chief accusation against him is that he is stupid. It is the ultimate accusation to be made against anybody in a world of professors and literary critics. He is stupid to be taken in by Iago in the way that he is. Well, okay, he isn't an intellectual like Hamlet. There's no reason he should be. Intellectuals don't make good generals. Generals have to act decisively in emergencies to take command, which Othello does very well. Hamlet does not. Othello may lack Hamlet's intellectual subtlety, but he is not stupid. He's at least as smart as Macbeth, and nobody has complained about Macbeth being stupid. Both are reasonably smart generals, prompt and heroic. Both get out of their depth because they are being manipulated by people who have a talent for psychic manipulation, who are up to no good. The stupidity charge comes up particularly because we see him accepting a string of lies and insinuations from Iago. And that bothers us. We don't want him to believe those things. And we forget that we know these characters better than they know each other. We know Iago is a liar. We've heard all his soliloquies. We know he hates Othello. Othello has no idea of that. We know that Desdemona is true to him. So we forget that Othello doesn't know the others that well, that he naturally trusts in Iago, a fellow soldier with whom he's been through long service, that he doesn't know Desdemona very well, that he doesn't know young Venetian women very well at all. His experience of women is limited. Now, I do not have the time, and it isn't suitable for the lecture format anyway, to go through the deception of Othello by Iago. It's a very long scene in Act 3, Scene 3. It's suitable for seminar discussion. You have to talk about line after line, how the various insinuations are planted. But I will take one moment. Where Iago has corrupted Othello's mind to a certain extent, and Othello makes a key transition which proves to be fatal. He says, "This fellow's of exceeding honesty and knows all qualities with a learned spirit of human dealings." He does trust Iago's experience of human affairs, and which is quite extensive. It's just that he's dishonest. And he goes on to think about Desdemona. "If I do prove her haggard, though that her jesses were my dear heartstrings, I'd whistle her off and let her down the wind to prey at fortune. If she is unfaithful to me, if she is likely to stray, if she is haggard, then she's not worth the bother. I'll whistle her off." Then something more happens. I mean, that's a possible solution to the problem. If a woman is faithless, oh, forget about her. Then he goes on, "Haply, for I am black and have not those soft parts of conversations that chamberers have. I'm not a courtly Venetian. Or for I am declined into the vale of years, yet that's not much. I'm middle-aged. She's gone. I am abused, and my relief must be to loathe her. My relief must be to loathe her." That's the key transition from saying, "I'll whistle her off," to saying, "My relief must be to loathe her." The movement, not from love to indifference, she's not worth my trouble, but from love to hatred, to rage. It's a move that happens in other Shakespearean plays, with white characters. Love, when it leaves, is not replaced by indifference, emptiness. It is replaced by its opposite. If order goes, chaos takes its place. If love goes, hatred, strife, anger takes its place. And Othello's mind does begin to collapse. He sees, in fact, his whole world coming apart. Farewell the tranquil mind. Farewell content. Farewell the plumed troop and the big wars that make ambition virtue. Oh, farewell the neighing steed and the shrill trump, the spirit-stirring drum, the ear-piercing fife, the royal banner, and all quality, pride, pomp, and circumstance of glorious war. Othello's occupation's gone. His identity was so invested in the relation with Desdemona that it's altogether gone. His occupation's gone. His generalship, his soldiership. Note that he had considered war to be an order-making activity. That's unusual for us because we think of war as almost unrelievedly bad. But war, from his point of view, is one of the ways of having order in life, of protecting civilization against the outer forces of barbarism, who in this play are the Turks. But with love going, order goes, his occupation goes, he goes. As a result, we have a succession of horrible scenes. The scenes where he demands the handkerchief from Desdemona, which she's accidentally lost, and Iago manages to twist into some kind of flimsy evidence for her infidelity. The scene where he strikes Desdemona in front of Lodovico. The scene in which he treats Desdemona as if she were a worker in a brothel, and Amelia as if she were the madam. Then he pulls himself together to some extent for the last scene. He wants to take revenge on his wife, but he doesn't want it to be an angry revenge. He wants it to be an execution of justice. He comes as a minister of justice, and yet he is crushingly aware of what she means to him. He still loves her. He finally does murder her in rage, but only because she is resisting. It isn't until the last scene of the play that Desdemona understands what's wrong with Othello, what she's been accused of. That she has been accused of adultery with Cassio. Well, send to Cassio and ask him. It isn't true. And the denial enrages Othello, he kills her in rage. Then there follows a curious silence, a curious laconic quality in Othello, as the various discoveries are made, as Amelia realizes what has been happening, that Iago has been telling lies, and she's willing to unfold the whole truth, and all of it comes out. Cassio comes in and said, I never gave you cause, and all that kind of thing. During all that stuff, Othello is going through some strange world where he has lost himself utterly. The original self that was destroyed by the belief in his wife's infidelity, and the second self that was gaining revenge. Somebody comes in and asks, where's Othello? And Othello says, there's he that was Othello. Here I am. An utter displacement of himself. He pulls himself together at the last moment to commit suicide. He anticipates the inevitable death penalty that will be passed upon him by a Venetian court and carries it out himself with this speech. Soft you, a word or two before you go. I have done the state some service, and they know it. No more of that. Speak of me as I am. Nothing extenuate, nor set down aught in malice. Then must you speak of one that loved not wisely, but too well, of one not easily jealous, but being wrought perplexed in the extreme. Set you down this, and say besides, that in Aleppo once, where a malignant and a turbaned Turk beat a Venetian and traduced the state, I took by the throat the circumcised dog and smote him thus. Cutting his throat on the last line, to the surprise of the others. Why should he remember the incident of the malignant and turbaned Turk who traduced the state? Because he traduced the state. Othello is the defender of Venetian civilization against barbarism, which in this play is represented by the Turks, the malignant and turbaned Turks. This is how he has lived his life. This is how he dies. Only now the barbarism is in himself. He is the offender who has traduced the state by killing Desdemona. He remains at the end, as he was at the beginning, the protector of civilization, the stalwart guardian at the gate.
The lectures on these tapes are titled William Shakespeare, Comedies, Histories, and Tragedies, Part 3.